Western culture have also changed to accommodate this shift in the way you see yourself. We named a number of them. As a way of thinking about this, we introduced this concept of culture as a kind of language. If you want to be, if you're visiting a foreign country, if you want to be recognized, if you want to be known, if you want to be accepted, you can, you know, get along visiting, speaking your own language, and kind of helping, asking other people to help you figure out what's being said. But if you really want to belong, what do you have to do? You have to learn language and talk with them, right? Cultures are like that too. To fit and be recognized in a culture requires that you know the language of the culture, the way, the things that are done and not done, the things that are said and not said, the things that are affirmed and not affirmed. And you kind of fit yourself into that, right? So we were noticing how the change, the individual change from a person identifying himself or herself by what is going on externally into the internal thing, that's matched by a cultural change of the language, in which now it's perfectly fine for someone to say, I'm a man trapped in a woman's body, and for you to say, no, you're not. You're speaking a foreign language. You're no longer part of this culture. Has changed so dramatically in the course of 100 years, so 200 years, however long it was, that's just not done. And there's, if you want to be recognized as a person and to be accepted as a person, you need to change your language. Last thing I wanted to talk about from last week, we didn't quite get to, is part of the reason this change has happened, and that is that we've switched over. The West has turned over from an honor culture to a dignity culture. And not all of this is bad. While we're talking about this section, Karl Schmidt is at pains to tell us, he's not saying that everything about this is bad, he's just noticing what's happened. So if you look at the bottom of page 9, that's where we will pick up. Terry, did you already pray? You did?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. Not that my mind was anywhere else, but I forgot. So, all right.
God bless you, man. I'm there.
So let's talk about an honor culture. And to get at the idea, let me just ask, and I'm not asking a Bible question here, I'm asking a how we feel about it question. What is it about the command, wives submit to your husbands, that modern people tend to find more difficult than ancient people? You didn't have, say, the 17th century, too many people upset by that command. Maybe there were, we don't know about it, but you see a lot of objection to it today. People trying to find a way around it, interpret it in such a way that it means wives don't really do anything like this at all. Why is that? What is it about this command that people find so difficult?
People think submission means
that you're less than, like you're not inherently as a human being equal to a man or to your husband. That's a really good point. And that actually gets to one of the key differences between an honor culture and a dignity culture. But does anyone have any other thoughts about that? So in an honor culture, medieval Europe was an honor culture, Japan and the feudal Japan was. The Hindu K system is an honor culture. A person's place in the social hierarchy is established at birth, and one must learn to live in accordance with the existing hierarchies. Give honor where honor is due. Paul even uses that language in this section. You're not really thinking in terms of, am I lesser ontologically in being Can my lord, let's say, I'll be a medieval peasant again. You're not really thinking in terms of, well, does my submission to Duke so-and-so and my giving taxes to him, does that mean I'm a lesser person? You're not thinking of this. So you think, oh, I'm a peasant. I'm farming on Duke so-and-so's land, and so I owe him honor. I owe him respect. He's my duke. This is a matter of course. Over the course of time, that has changed. Several reasons for that change. One is technological development. In the Middle Ages, conforming yourself to the lord who owns the land was necessary for life and to thrive economically in every other way. But as technology increased and industry and the rise of the middle class and business weakened the authority and the power of the lord, and it was easier to perceive a life outside of those boundaries. So as technology changed, the need for those old hierarchies changed, and the arguments supporting them began to weaken. It's a little bit like we're saying with the sexuality thing, that when there was no birth control and there was no protection against sexually transmitted disease, no way to prevent pregnancy, then the laws surrounding, or the kind of social rules surrounding sexuality, don't have sex outside of marriage, made a lot more sense to people. But you take those things away, and gradually the argument for keeping those rules there seems, well, I can have this sexual relationship without any risk of pregnancy or disease. Why not? The moral reason for it goes away. The same thing here with hierarchies, like the feudal system. As technology changed, the basis or the reason for hierarchies also seem to be less reasonable. And there are the intellectual developments. We talked about some of this last week. There's this mission, the self moving to the center. So if you have no reason demanding that you conform yourself to your lord, and your perception of self has radically changed, well, that leads to a change from what's called an honor culture to a dignity culture. I'll just read what he says here. This move found its most eloquent psychological expression in the work of Rousseau, for whom society and culture were problems, the things that corrupted the individual and prevented him from being his truly authentic. Even that the hierarchies of honor-based societies would be examples of precisely the kind of corrupting conventions that the egalitarian Rousseau would have regarded with disdain, the clear notion is that all human beings are created intrinsically equal. Man is born free, and everywhere is in chains, this is from Rousseau. And the implication of this thinking is that all human beings, therefore, must possess equal dignity. And that gets right back to what Ben is saying. So once this idea of everybody having equal dignity is accepted, and it's not a bad idea, I think it's a biblical idea, but Rousseau wasn't using the Bible to argue for it. Then you begin to say, well, why does so-and-so have more authority over me since we have equal dignity? Why do those hierarchies exist? Now, it's kind of interesting here, because when you go to the Bible, you find God saying both, everyone is made in God's image, and there are hierarchies. But what happened at this period of history is one of those two things God was challenged. The emphasis on human dignity began to challenge the existence of hierarchies.
You see this in the modern age with the rise of communism and the communist idea of socialism. You know, the idea of the dignity of the worker, the individual.
Right.
You know, it pits one class against another.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's not that you no longer are part of the community. It's just that everybody in the community should have equal,
right. equal. They want to put everything on an even plane.
Now, if you have equal dignity, the calculus is you should also have equal authority, equal
classes.
Right, exactly. So, equal dignity relativizes the importance of the external circumstances and hierarchies are the product of society, and therefore corrupting. So, just a question throughout there, just discussion. What are some hierarchies in our culture, and on what are they based? What would you say? Do you know what I mean by hierarchy? Yeah.
I would say those that are in business have, you know, or entrepreneurs or whatever, they are considered a very hierarchy in our culture, you know, with Steve Jobs, etc.
That's a great point. We do see hierarchies often. They're based on achievement, right? You carving a space out in the world gives you authority. Based on merit, based on, well, at least that the theory is based on merit, based on what you've accomplished. There was very little room for that in medieval Europe. The rise in the middle class began to change that, but before it, that you just were. So that's one hierarchy that definitely points to this change in the idea of dignity, because if it's true that you can gain authority or gain a place, a higher place in society on the basis of your achievement, that's grounded in the idea of everybody having equal dignity. You can be whatever you want to be. If you try hard, you can get to the top. It doesn't matter where you're born. It doesn't matter who your mom and dad is. It matters what you do. But even that idea is beginning to be challenged a little bit, right? Isn't it? I mean, what are some other hierarchies that might maybe conflict with that?
Yeah. There's a kind of an oppression hierarchy.
Yeah.
Depending on where you fit in the oppression social matrix, the more checks you have against you, the higher your voice and opinion counts.
Yes, there's intersectionality. This idea that if you, in our culture now, in fact, we recently just had an example of this at Binghamton University. It made national news. I'm not sure if you heard about it. But a BU professor said that she was going to center non-male, non-white voices. And so, if she had this in her syllabus, if I threw out a question like I just did, and Ben raised his hand, I would have to say, Ben, you can't speak right now. I'm waiting for the women, for the people of color, to speak.
Well, that's cool.
and that's born out of this idea that, well, because of the oppression that's taking place in the past, people of color and people who are not male, women, haven't been centered, haven't been heard. And so the white male has to step aside and let the women and the people of color and the people of different orientations be heard. And the more notches you have on your belt, like I'm a woman, I'm a person of color, I'm gay, whatever it might be. If you're all three of those things, you are, and you're not Christian. If you're also, you know, Buddhist, but you've got it made. You are in the high, you've gained a high status, not because of anything you've done, but because of just the way the self is perceived in our kind of culture, and the way that, we'll talk about this in this chapter, which is the victim ideology that's become the predominant. Someone else had a hand up, but yes.
I would say that's kind of a hierarchy of victimhood, and then of course what you were addressing was the flip side of the hierarchy of privilege, which of course is the opposite.
Yeah. It's flipped. It's flipped from being born into privilege by having a high place, and being born into privilege by being born because of the color of your skin or your sex.
And it's interesting how, like, what you said about achievement, the hierarchy of achievement is, you know, was like semi-merit based historically.
Yeah.
And these new, more powerful current hierarchies are not merit based, they're historically based.
Yeah. It's a mirror image of the old hierarchy of birth. Corrupted, I would say. That same idea is there. You're born into a certain kind of privilege, power. All right, so yeah, good stuff. Any other thoughts or comments here? Yep.
Man, I was just going to say, just about, like, colleges today are accepting people people of color over people of white. That's just a mix of them.
I don't get too far into that because he talks about that in chapter two, but yes, I mean, it's an interesting change, and it has had ramifications throughout our culture. In fact, I think the argument back to you would be, I'm not making it, but they would say, well, you enjoy a kind of privilege because of your color and your sex that these people haven't had, and so you need to divest yourself of that privilege and repent of that privilege and give it to others. You let them have your place. There's a lot of problems with that, but I don't have time to address it now. But when we come to that section in this book, he deals with it pretty well. So no, good stuff. I'm glad you brought that up. All right. So the net result, this is bottom page 10. The net result of the collapse of traditional hierarchies is that notions of honor no longer shape the pattern of social engagement, and therefore of recognition in today's society. That role is now played by the notion of dignity, which each and every person, human being, possesses not by virtue of their social status, but simply by being human. This egalitarian concept changes everything in theory, and as it therefore comes to change everything in practice, it almost invariably involves conflict, for it brings us back to that important point concerning, this is his work for that language I was talking about, if you learn the language of a culture, Sipikite, a society. How does society understand identity, and what range of identities does it consider to be legitimate? If I am to be recognized and if I am to belong, then there needs to be conformity between that social reality and my personal reality. And sometimes that conformity needs to be realized through conflict, whereby the ethics of one group or era are consciously defeated by those of another. That's what's happening now. You bringing up Merritt, or maybe it's Terry, bringing up the businessman who climbs his way up to the top. That's an older form of hierarchy and dignity culture that's being overthrown by this newer one that Daryl brought up. So it's interesting that we see this happening. The person who objects to homosexual practice is in contemporary society actually objecting to homosexual identity and the refusal by any individual to recognize an identity that society at large recognizes as legitimate is a moral offense, not simply a matter of indifference. The question of identity in the modern world is a question of dignity. So because we've changed into a dignity culture and we in our culture identify as understands dignity in a particular way, that's why we find ourselves in so much contention and conflict. When you say, no, I don't think you're a woman because you have the body of a male, you have stepped outside of at least you're perceived as questioning that person's dignity. As our cultural language understands dignity, you've stepped outside of it. And so of course you're gonna have people come down on you. You can question their personhood. You may not mean to, but that's the way they're gonna feel. That's the end of chapter one. So I'm taking this three times, three sessions through chapter one. But now we're going to move into chapter two. He begins with a series of questions here, and I'll throw them out. We don't have to answer them because he's going to answer them as we go. But we can talk about them if you want. The first question is, why does our social imaginary, who remembers what social imaginary is?
What we intuitively believe about
all
is our morals, or like our intuitive worldview.
Our intuitive worldview is our social imaginary. So I gave you that Disney story. The reason that Disney story made sense is because we intuitively understand certain ideas and concepts and philosophies without even having studied the philosophies themselves. We just live in an environment and we pick up the beliefs and the conventions of the environment intuitively. So we intuitively know what people mean because there's signs out in the front. The love is love sign. You know what they're talking about. It makes sense to us. It makes sense to us when someone says, I'm a man trapped in a woman's body, even if we don't agree with it, because we are part of this. We have a particular social imaginary in which we live and move. So why does our social imaginary make sex such a basic marker of identity? and attitudes to sex such a fundamental test for recognition? Remember, we all want recognition. That's why you would learn another language if you go into another culture. We all want to be recognized. We don't want to be picked for the dodgeball team. We don't want to be left out. So what is it, why is sex so basic right now to help people identify themselves, and attitudes to sex such a fundamental test for recognition? So much so that if you don't affirm, you're not recognized. That's the first question. The other question is, why does the public need to know the sexual orientation of movie stars or their attitude toward gay marriage? That's weird. Celebrities get canceled for not saying the right things about canceled, meaning they can get fired from their movie studio. They won't get more jobs working as actors or actresses if they have the wrong opinions about this kind of thing. Why does it matter? Because, I mean, what they think about these things, does it affect their job performance? Are they less able to act if they have a disapproved view of sexuality? For some reason, our society wants to know, like, what firemen think about sexuality. There's a police chief in some city, I forgot where. He was fired because he posted on social media. So I think it was just a biblical text. I think it was just a biblical text about homosexuality, and he's fired. Why has that happened? When neither question about gay marriage or sexual orientation, neither is relevant to their technical competence to pursue their profession. There have been a lot of parents going to school board meetings to protest what they believe to be, and I kind of agree with them, indoctrination into various kind of leftist ideologies in public schools. And I read an article this week where I think this was in Michigan. The principal and some of the school board members then sort of trolling parents' social media pages, looking for incriminating posts, like things that might mark them off as homophobic, and they would send them to their employers to get them fired from their jobs. It was just like in cities. They're being sued right now, thank God. It was just that. Why is our culture that way?
Sounds like Scientology.
No, that's an interesting point. We studied Scientology once a long time ago, and we talked about how if you leave Scientology, you got a target on your back. They're coming after you. So interesting. Why is it so important to educate even elementary school children in the taxonomy of sexual preference? Have you guys seen the gender unicorn? Okay, so kids in elementary school, they're given a worksheet, and basically, I'm not going to be able to draw it right, but you're going to have to get the picture. This is like a gender hippopotamus, but all right, this is a unicorn. Here's the horn. anyway, there's like a circle around where the private part should be, and there's a circle around the heart, right? And the kids are taught that what's here doesn't necessarily fit here, and here's where you are. Right? Here's where you can. If you don't feel like you're a boy, then it doesn't matter what this is. Right here, are you attracted to other boys or other girls? Do you want to be with boys more than other girls? Or boys more than girls? If you're a boy, then, well, that's, they're taught very, very early on to identify themselves by these things. Why? Why are we doing that for school children? Yeah, the brain, the gender unicorn doesn't have a brain. He has a heart and genitals. All right, so broader question. What are the pathologies of our cultural moment that have provided context for such acrimonious culture wars over sex identity? So these are all the questions that we're going to work through in this chapter. Any questions here about this question or thoughts about this question? All right, so the first concept he introduces is another one from Philip Reeve, I think. And that is a third world culture. I've got to have it. There it is. I have it at home. I have a whole bunch of blue markers that are in my pocket that I could come, and I haven't brought them back. Okay, third world culture. What do you usually think of when you hear that term, third world? Developing country. Do you think of any a developing country in Africa or South America or something? That's not what the term means here. He's not talking about economic development, infrastructure development at all. He's talking about cultures. Okay, so a first world culture is a culture in which law, ethics, and virtue are grounded in something external, the gods, some kind of myth. So if we were to ask the average second century Roman, you know, why should the Christians be persecuted? What do you think he would say, or she would say? Why should we feed these Christians to the lions?
They're considered atheists.
They're considered atheists? Well, so what?
They weren't...
Maybe not that, man. Right.
Well, they didn't honor the state gods.
Ah, they didn't honor the gods. And when you don't honor the gods, what happens?
The gods get angry and stop giving you rain and whatever you need.
Yes, we had a drought last year. Whose fault was that? It was the Christians. They're not honoring the gods. We need to throw them into the lions and give them and appease the gods. So there's a morality there. Everyone should honor the gods. And if you're not honoring the gods, you're going to be sanctioned. There's a morality there that comes from beyond. The example that was used in the book was by Sergius, I think he was the first Spartan who gave the Spartan laws. If you were to say, ask him, why should we keep your laws? He wouldn't say, because I said so. He would say, because the Oracle at Delphi sanctioned these laws, and so that's why we follow them. Okay? First world cultures always have a grounding in some kind of sacred myth, sacred order. In that sense, they're like second world cultures. Second world cultures ground their ethics, their law, their culture in religion. So here's a question. Why would an 18th century Roman Catholic say that sex outside of marriage is wrong? And why would a Protestant of the same era say that same-sex marriage is wrong? What would be the basis upon which a Roman Catholic would say that it's wrong?
The church always said it's wrong.
The church has always said it's wrong, and the scriptures, so they're biblical, right? Church says this is wrong, and the church is a divine institution, and the Bible says it's wrong, and the Bible is God's word. Tradition's always held this, so we're going to believe this. A Protestant might say it a little bit differently. He might agree, yep, tradition says this, and we should honor tradition, but he would say, ultimately, it's because the Bible says this is wrong, we do this wrong. What do they have in common?
God.
An idea that the morality, whenever when we're talking about a moral question or an ethical question, we get those from beyond. They might disagree about the foundation, like how exactly the foundation is worked out, but they both agree we need to ground our ethics in what God has given us. And so, in the second world culture, you can have conflict. I mean, my goodness, the Reformation was a conflict, wasn't it? But no one was saying, hey, let's throw over all the rules and do our own thing. Everyone's trying to say, let's follow God. Let's do what God would have us do. So in that way, the Reformation wasn't a revolution. I mean, whatever side you fall on that, it's not a revolution. It was just a way of arguing about what the foundations were. Same thing with the debate about slavery and in the South. Both sides, the pro-slavery and the anti-slavery side, grounded their arguments in what? Scripture. They were both looking to a higher authority to ground their argument. And that higher authority is God and religion. And thank God that the anti-slavery side went out But to say that a reason that's important to note is because to say that a second world culture is a culture that relies on law, on religion for law, ethics, and virtue is not to say that a second world culture can't change for the better, can't undergo transformation. It can. It's the basis of that transformation is a different thing. All right, third world cultures do not root their cultures, social orders, or moral imperatives in anything sacred or transcendent. And Phil Reese, who put this together, says those cultures are inherently unsteady. We can, in a second world, we can always say, well, why shouldn't I have sex outside of marriage? Well, because God said so. And God's God, he knows better than I do. In a third world culture, what is it? Why not? I mean, you could say, I don't want to. That's fine. But is there any real reason? Maybe you're afraid of getting some kind of disease, but we have things to help you with that now. What reason would you have to say, I don't think you should do this? In a third world culture, the basis for saying that anyone should do anything is weakened. Because morality, ethics, reduced down to preference rather than what we think is right or wrong.
Yes, yeah. Within second worlds, like you pointed out, there are conflicting worldviews. So like one religion might operate under the rules of chess, and another religion might operate under the rules of checkers.
Right.
But like when they're engaging, they're both at that same reference point,
yeah.
As opposed to, somebody who is a denizen, a denizen of the second world engaging with someone in the third world, that's like showing up expecting a chess match and somebody holds a knife. You're on two different levels of how this conflict is going to operate.
Yeah, I can, if I'm talking to a Muslim who believes the Quran, I have a basis for a conversation. Both have the same idea about morality, about virtue being given by God.
Even if they're different ideas of what that morality is, what you are.
Even if we have different ideas and different, he look at his Quran, I look at my Bible, we think, okay, you should look at the Quran, we can argue about that. But if I'm talking to somebody who doesn't believe there's a God, or, okay, we'll talk about this in a minute, a little later, who doesn't believe there's any ultimate purpose for the person, beyond the person, then you lose any kind of ground to really talk about it. What do you think the purpose of marriage is? Anyone? Huh? Because there's several of them, aren't there? Huh? What?
To reflect Christ in the church.
Yeah, it's going to be right for the highest one, which is to reflect Christ in his church, right? So that in itself is reason why you only want one man and one woman, because you don't want to say that Jesus, who is the masculine symbol there, is cheating on his church, and you don't want to say that the woman is unfaithful to Jesus. So you have that image itself justifies one man and one woman. But then you go and you have different commands that say don't do these things, because the human person's purpose, what is it? It's to glorify God. And now you take all that away. There's no. What's the purpose of marriage without God? Well, there might be some. Well, try to think of a purpose for marriage without God.
Business partnership.
Business partnership, right? There's some tax advantages for it.
What would you do for me? Personal fulfillment.
Personal fulfillment, yeah. I mean, that people do now, I think, get married in large part because you complete me. You make me whole. You're the other side of me. There's a personal fulfillment.
And also, like, practically, like, procreation in a safe environment where it's, a safe, positive environment where you can raise a family.
Yeah, if you're into the baby raising thing, I guess you could say we could.
The immortality that comes with continuing the generation like that, that's an appeal to some,
Some people do think, okay, it's better to raise a baby.
Have a, what's it called, like, a, you know, like when you, legacy, yeah, have a legacy in that way.
But within that, isn't that necessarily a man and a woman? I mean, you could just have two women and have get some artificial insemination or something like that, and have a baby, or you could adopt.
I mean, you could do, absolutely.
So it doesn't have to be man and a woman. It doesn't have to be one man and one woman either. It can be multiple. If there's no ultimate end or purpose for marriage and all kinds of things, yeah, become possible. Because the real end, I guess, not no end, but the real end is self-fulfillment, like being pleased. And if I'm pleased and my wife is pleased, then we can stay together. Or if I'm pleased and my wife wants to be with someone else and that pleases her and I'm okay with it, well, it doesn't matter. There's no telos, there's no end there to govern our relationships anymore if it's reduced down, if the sacred is taken out of our order. Without a sacred order, the social order begins to collapse, or at least begins to dramatically change. So I just, as an illustration, when younger parents with younger kids are going to find this heavy. When a child asks, why should I eat my peas? And you say, because I said so, why does that answer work? When it works. Not that it always works, but when it works, why does that answer work?
It's an argument from authority.
It's an argument from authority. Your kid may not know why I have to eat my peas. I hate my peas. My dad says I eat my peas. I know if I don't eat my peas, I'm going to get punished. And if I do eat my peas, well, I can get up to my chair and go play. Okay. My dad says, I'll eat my peas. He knows somewhere in there that he knows better than I do, whatever, I'll go ahead and do it. But then, you know, what happens if you're 25 and you're visiting your house or your parents come over to your house and your dad says, eat your peas. And you say, why? Then I said so. And I mean, I guess if you're a good, respectful son, you could do it. But the reasoning behind that doesn't really hold anymore, right? Because it just goes away. That's kind of what's happened to our culture. Before, we had God saying, do this, don't do this. This is the purpose of life. This is not the purpose of life. Now, the God, Nietzsche said, God is dead. Right? No, he's not really, but that's to our culture, he's dead. And so, when I say to somebody outside in the street, well, you shouldn't do that because God says not to do that. Who are you talking about? Why does it even matter? So abandonment of the sacred order leaves cultures without any foundation. The culture with no sacred order, therefore, has the task, for Reeve, the impossible task, of justifying itself only by reference to itself. First worlds, third world, or second worlds, justify themselves by reference to the sacred. Morality will thus tend toward a matter of simple, consequentialist pragmatism, with the notion of what are and are not desirable outcomes being shaped by the distinct cultural pathologies of the day. And our cultural pathology, he's already shown us, is the self needing to be fulfilled, the self wanting to be happy. And so the question in every moral equation in a third world culture is, will this make me happy? Is this what I need to be happy? Very practical. The ends justify the means. If this will make me happy, I do it. As he says later, we even add like quasi-moral justifications for it. That we kind of take the place of, well, God said this. When someone says, when you ask someone why they did something, and then so that just felt like it was the right thing to do. I just felt like it was the right thing to do. What does that mean? I just felt it was the right thing to do. My heart told me this is what I should be doing right now. See, the instead of appealing to a sacred order, you begin to appeal to the thing, the self, as the transcendent, almost, the transcendent authority. Yeah.
So like the Bible said, every man did what was right in his own eyes.
Yes, it's very biblical. It's playing out in a very biblical way. So to this, is yourself to understand this idea of third world a little more, he adds another concept, which is called the immanent frame. You can see at the bottom of page 11. The world of the immanent frame is a world in which this world is all it is, is an order without reference to God in which nature itself is seen to be the blueprint for social order. God slowly becomes an unnecessary hypothesis. And to try to get to the bottom of this, let's ask a question. In Darwinistic evolution, what role does God play? I'm not talking about theistic evolution, which I disagree with, but there's a different, I'm talking about Darwinistic. Evolution as Darwin conceived of it. If it's true, what role does God play?
I don't think any, really.
God, he's completely absent from the process. Darwin set out to prove that he could explain the origin of life and its development without reference to God. Mm. And he used, if you study it all, you know what he used, and I'm not a scientist, I'm not going to go into it, but he claims to have done it. So now, if Darwinistic evolution is true, what is the human being? What are you? You're a cosmic accident. I mean, you should, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why if the billions of series of random things could happen some other way, and you wouldn't be here. You wouldn't be here. Yeah, what's your purpose? I mean, you might say to reproduce. Huh?
Your purpose is whatever you decide it is, because you create yourself. You're your own creator.
There is no large meaning. I guess you could say your biological purpose is to reproduce under an evolutionary framework, but there's no like meaning to it. I mean, so if you get smashed in the road by a big bus, it's okay. There's lots of, if you're part of the weaker ones, but there's smarter ones who won't get run over by buses, and they'll be able to reproduce and put their genes into the next generation. But there's no meaning to it. There's no inherent meaning to it. Yeah,
so if Darwinism is correct and nihilism is correct, Nietzsche is correct, then
right,
there's no meaning, but everything's just up for grabs. All of life is kingdom, whatever you want to live.
Right, exactly.
Maybe the social contracts are arbitrary, like our government system, any kind of cultural social contract, it's all subjective.
Yeah, it is. And it really begins, again, a matter of preference and power. Who has the most power to put forward their preferences and maintain them? That it is. I think that even though I doubt very seriously that like too many people know Darwin's theory of evolution, they were probably taught it in high school and in elementary school, like little parts of it. I doubt that they were like thinking about it alone. In a deep sense, but the idea that there's no ultimate purpose has certainly gotten into our social imaginary. It's certainly gotten into the way that we just intuitively think about things. Or that we make our own purpose, because there's no external purpose. I think most people kind of operate in that frame. I choose my own end, I choose my own purpose. There's no overarching purpose that I fit myself into. I carve out my own world.
But they also experience the feeling that they know they're
going to
die
someday. Yeah, because in all of this, keep in mind, Carl Jung's a Christian, so he knows that a lot of this, a lot of people, the way people think, is also, it's used, a lot of the social imaginary, a lot of the things that people say about love is love are just used to kind of cover over the conscience and the real knowledge of our coming death, and God's written his law in our hearts, but we've become very sophisticated at covering that stuff up.
Yeah. I'd like a dollar for every time I said, don't kill the messenger.
yeah. Right. But I think maybe you can see why people might want to kill the messenger now, because when you say, I can't affirm your lifestyle, you're questioning a person's dignity, you're questioning a person's identity, you're questioning a person's self. I mean, you're hurting someone. At least they would say. I don't think so, but they would say that. Scott, did you have a question?
I was just going to follow up the whole idea of these mass murders, Columbine, things like that. We never want them to happen, but those are great ways to engage with people about meaning. Why is
this so bad?
Why did what they do? They believed in something. And yes, it was against the law, but that was their choice, their perspective, and you can just...
Yeah.
It really challenged them, and that's, you know, Prince Schaefer called it pulling, taking the roof off. So show what the world's like if there is no meaning and how you only have to spare, basically.
Right.
And it's a really good tool to engage people.
Right, right.
To challenge their assumptions.
And that's it. I like that. And it goes a lot like the book we studied before this, which was, I forgot what it's called. But the asking questions to do that, to take the roof off, to make someone think through the assumptions they've just gotten by as part of this culture. They don't even think through, they just accept. So third world imminent frame cultures do not build their moral codes in a sacred order, renders their cultures profoundly volatile and subject to confusion and collapse. And he uses here abortion as a good example of the way this can happen. On what did the prohibition, or does the prohibition against abortion rest? So for us, what would we say? Why would we say you can't get an abortion?
Because there's a life made in the image of God.
God gave that child life at the moment of conception. That child's made in God's image. So to damage the child in any way is an attack on God, really. It's a kind of a blasphemous attack on his image. It's abortion is abhorrent to people who have a sacred order, generally. I mean, let's say Christians, take Christians in particular. For us, our sacred order would make abortion abhorrent. You see that all the way back through Christian history. You know, the fathers of the church, just one of the things that set them apart from Roman pagan culture was their insistence that we don't abort babies, we don't expose babies after they're born, we take them in because they're made in God's image. Having that concept, does, like when someone says to you who's for abortion, he says, what about babies or embryos who can't live apart from their mother, who are totally dependent on their mother's body, who would die if they were taken out? Does that make any difference to us?
No.
Why not? Because the worth of that child has nothing to do with viability. Same reason we don't just go and kill people when they cease to be productive or cease to be able to live a quality life as we would say so. We don't do the Dr. Kevorkian because that person has a life that God has given that person, and that person's made in God's image. It's why we don't kill ourselves, right? We are made in God's image, and he's the author of life. There's a whole understanding of purpose that you have as a member of a sacred order society, which is what Christianity is, that others don't share. So removing that sacred, how would you then, we know what a person is, a person is made in God's image, but removing the sacred, how do you define a person? What are some ways you might define personhood without God?
A consciousness,
right? So that makes sense, I guess, because you don't, if babies, first week of a conceived child's life, there's not a lot of thought going on in there. can we really even say that person has personhood? He's not self-conscious. That's one way we might say it. What's another?
You already said it, but viability.
Yeah, viability. If he's already dependent on the mother, then the mother may not want to have that thing dependent on him. And human beings, we could define human beings as people who are able to be independently living. That might be one way we do it. Suggestion that Kay gave, you can have arguments within this world, within a world without the sacred. Someone might come back to you and say, a person in a coma doesn't have consciousness, so can we off him? And you'd have to think of a reason not to. And that gets to this point that if there can be no agreement on, this is page 12, if there can be no agreement on what constitutes personhood in a non-sacred order, then in a therapeutic psychological manner, which we talked about last week, if you go back and listen to it, other criteria come into play. And we see it happening right now, right? Whether giving birth to the child will be conducive to the mother's mental well-being. And so if we can't agree about when a child is a person or whether an unborn child is a person, well, the thing that comes to the fore then is the mother, right? You know, she's a person. What does she want? Will it make her life better or worse to have this child? And what if it makes the mother's life worse? What would be the right thing to do? I mean, it's almost reversed that in some cases, a woman having an abortion is a very good thing because she's acting in accordance with her, she's living out her true authentic self. She's not letting the baby get in the way of that. And she's not being hurt by the baby by being able to live out herself again.
Which lines up with the Shout Your Abortion movement.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a brand new thing. You heard the Shout Your Abortion movement? I mean, you go on social media and also at various protests, and women are just shouting proudly about having abortions. I saw one of the women with the t-shirt, I've had 10 abortions or something. And that's seen as a good thing because she's not letting the structures of the second world, the sacred order, impose itself on her, on herself. Yes.
And also with that idea, with consciousness as the idea of personhood, there's also the child would someday become a person, like when it's like 5 or something like that, it'd actually be a real person. And if you say, well, that child wouldn't have a good life once it becomes a person, so you don't let it become a person and have a bad life.
Right.
So then you have the abortion first. And so it's almost
you're doing a good thing,
it's an unselfish act. You prevented that child from ever becoming a person and having a bad life. So you're protecting that future person.
That kid is going to be raised in a bad environment and not have enough food, maybe, and not have enough supply of resources. So,
well, like a common example is kids who would probably end up in the foster care system.
Yeah, exactly. Or if you were pregnant, I remember 6 times then. They wanted to test to see, if your baby has any problems, right? And if the baby has any problems, they're going to put pressure on you to abort the baby because you don't want to bring a child like that into the world. It's better for the child. It's better for you. That's it. You will get a lot of pressure because the child's not made the image of God. This is
Not to get off on a rabbit trail, but I recently saw that those tests are something like 80% inaccurate.
Oh, really? Wow. Yeah. That's a good thing to know.
Very high rate of inaccuracy.
That's a very good thing to know. We just decided we weren't going to take the test because it didn't matter. The results didn't matter, so why would we take it? And the doctors, we were in Virginia at the time, and we didn't know the doctor personally. So she was really mean about it. Why wouldn't you want to do this? You're saving, because if you find out the baby has a problem, then you have your whole life, you're going to take care of it, and the medical community's going to take care of it. And you're going to be a burden on others, this baby's not just going to be a burden on you, but on others, if you at least know what's going on. So yeah, thanks for that information, it's good to know.
It's not all the tests, but they expanded the suite with a bunch of rare diseases, and the rarer they are, the less accurate they are, but they still act as if it's like super duper accurate, but people are now investigating the stats and they're just horribly inaccurate.
Yeah. Those trust the science moments.
Science is real, Matt.
right. So we have about a minute left, and let me just read this. I'm not going to read it. I had a woman in one of our Bible studies who we were kind of agreeing, I thought. We're talking about abortion. And she said, I would never want abortion except in the case where the mother's life was under threat. And I said, okay, well, I see your point. I don't think there's ever really a time like that, but I can see your argument. But then as she was talking, it came to me, the reality was the life of the mother is in danger
if she can't go to college, if she can't, have her career, because then she's not happy, and so her life is endangered by that thought. So be careful if we use that language. I'm for outlawing abortion, except for the case of the life of the mother. Sometimes is trying to slip in, and life of the mother means
the
quality, of life,
the psychological well-being of the mother.
Exactly.
Once you replace reference to God as the objective standard with reference to self as the objective standard, then keeping someone from getting an abortion becomes an assault on the divine, because self is divine.
She's God. I can do with my this other being what I or whatever. I can do whatever I want. You're blaspheming against the self God. That's a really good point. Really good insight. We are out of time. I'll pick up here in page 12 next week. Any closing thoughts or comments or questions?
Love Nietzsche. I haven't really read him, but the madman and running around screaming that we've been changing the world from the sun, call it out. Like, we can't just live in echoes of a second world culture. If you truly, profess third culture beliefs, then you can't rest your morals or your grounding or your worldview on all this stuff you're rejecting from the second world. Like, it's got to be hotter.
And Nietzsche saw that so clearly. And he wasn't afraid to say, he's got to unmoor ourselves from all the old morality. And become our own gods. Yeah.
Like, he actually thought
he
it
said
through
that. Yeah.
And said,
it's brilliant.
You gotta do it.
Unapologetic, the fact that you can't have it both ways. You can't both reject God and then hold on to the convenient aspects of a God-based culture.
Yeah. Now, as I'm reading this stuff, Nietzsche's clearly a big part of our social imaginary, even though so few people have read Nietzsche. It's fascinating. Thank you. Terry, you pray for us?
Yes.
Yes.